It's wonderful to see you all. Many of you I've met a couple years ago, and it's exciting to be back in Montreal. Some might think that it's redundant to hold events like this over and over again, but keep in mind that International Apartheid Week, Israeli Apartheid Week, excuse me, is in its sixth year of existence, and it's only growing. So that repetition is actually development and not status, in the same way that divestment is a long process and something that continues to grow. So I'll be excited if you all want to invite me back for the next few years as well. So with that, in response to systematic anti-Semitism in Europe, Jewish Europeans had several options. Among them was a Bundist socialist movement aimed at diminishing nationalism's ethnic chauvinism in order to fully integrate into European society as equals. Another option was a Zionist national movement seeking to create a Jewish homeland. The horrific events that aimed at ethnically cleansing Jews and other minorities in Europe during the Second World War catalyzed the Zionist movement and eclipsed all other options in response to the looming Jewish question. Zionists also had a choice of Jewish homelands, among them Mozambique, Uganda, and Palestine. As a result of its association with the British Empire, as well as historical religious claims to Palestine, the Zionist movement chose Palestine. After several waves of Jewish immigration, the Jewish population in historic Palestine in 1948 only constituted 7% of the land, ownership of 7% of the land, and 650,000. In their immigration to Palestine, Zionist leaders had a choice. Again, notice this is a series of choices. To coexist with their Palestinian counterparts and integrate into mandatory Palestine, or to rid the land of its inhabitants in order to constitute a majority and establish itself as a Jewish democracy. They chose the latter because the goal of Zionism, or the Zionist movement from the beginning, was to create a state in which Jews comprised 85% of the population. As put by new historian Benny Morris, quote, Ben-Gurion understood that there could be no Jewish state with a large and hostile Arab minority in its midst. That had to be clear. It's impossible to evade it. Without the uprooting of the Palestinians, a Jewish state would not have arisen there, end quote. And so based on that choice, Zionists demolished 531 Arab villages and expelled 700,000 Palestinians from what is today Israel proper. Moshe Dayan, a former Israeli defense minister, recounts, quote, Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You do not even know the names of Arab villages, and I do not blame you because geography books no longer exist. Not only do the books not exist, the Arab villages are not there either. There is not a single place in this country that did not have a former Arab population. Today, within Israel proper, the 100,000 Palestinians who did not become refugees constitute 20% of Israel's population. Additionally, 3.5 million Palestinians live under military occupation in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. Taking the whole of mandatory Palestine into account, today there exist 6.3 million Jews and 5.9 million Palestinians, figures that hardly meet the vision of an 85% majority of Jews. More daunting for this demographic equation, within Israel proper alone, Palestinian citizens, Muslim and Christian Palestinian citizens of Israel, will outnumber their Jewish counterparts by 2025. So what does that mean for the Jewish state that seeks to be both Jewish and democratic, but maintain a demographic majority of 85%? It leaves Israel with four choices. First, it can reevaluate its equation and opt for a state of all its citizens, irrespective of their religion. Second, it can eventually allow a Jewish minority to rule over a Christian and Muslim Palestinian majority. Third, it can establish the two-state solution and compromise on its vision of a greater Israel. Or fourth, it can adopt measures to limit the presence and growth of its now minority population. So let's go through each of these options. Israel has never considered the first option very seriously. Instead, today it has made its aversion to secular coexistence explicit and its demand for recognition of itself as a Jewish state from Palestinian leadership and their negotiating partners. It has also done what it can to avoid the second option, because as put by former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, failure to create a Palestinian state would force Israel to, quote, face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights, and as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished, end quote. More recently, former Prime Minister and current Defense Minister Ehud Barak explained, if and as long as between Jordan and the sea there is only one political entity named Israel, it will end up being either non-Jewish or non-democratic. If the Palestinians vote in elections, it is a binational state. If they don't, it is apartheid. And so, of course, this is a narrow conception of apartheid, conceiving it of only as a state where the minority rules a majority, except as I will later discuss and Naeem will later discuss, that's not the definition of apartheid. But this suffices to demonstrate that there is no vision of secular coexistence in a single state. So this brings us to the third option, the creation of two states for two peoples. Despite the rhetoric of the pragmatic nature of the two-state solution, especially in light of the rising legitimacy of the one-state solution, this option is hardly plausible in the face of Israeli settlements. Israel's red lines prohibiting full sovereignty of a Palestinian state, and the fact that Palestinian self-determination would not flow from an end to occupation in any case. The greatest impediment to establishing an independent Palestinian state, of course, is the Israeli manufactured Frankenstein in the West Bank, known as settlements. Doubled from a 200,000 to a 400,000 settler population between 1993 and 2000, the so-called peace process years, the settlements now constitute an intractable presence, one that has not been budged, not by an international legal advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice, not even by the sponsor and the caretaker of Israel, the United States, which provides more $3 billion annually a year to Israel just in aid alone, not counting military aid or other forms of loan guarantees. Even from the mouth of the US, when this current US administration stated explicitly its opposition to settlements and their illegality, that was not enough to cease the expansion of settlements in the West Bank. Consider also Israel's five red lines to a Palestinian state, including no right of return for refugees, no compromise as dividing Jerusalem as a joint capital, no return to the 1967 borders, and no standing Palestinian army in any future Palestinian state. By any definition of sovereignty and statehood, this is a pathetic state. But for the sake of argument, let's imagine that this would be enough. Consider also that Palestinian self-determination would not flow from an end to the occupation alone. Due to its prolonged nature, the Israeli occupation has outgrown the confines of belligerent occupation as outlined by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Belligerent occupation, or the presence of an external force not sanctioned by international agreement, is meant to be short and therefore swiftly remedied by returning to the status quo ante. Prolonged occupation coupled with the systematic policy of affording racial privilege, on the one hand, places the occupied population in a state of political and legal limbo, whose grievances cannot be remedied by the end of occupation alone. Instead, the requisite solution must address such limbo by targeting the laws and policies that uphold structural discrimination. So disavowing a secular state, as well as an explicitly South African state model, which is a questionable state model presented by Israeli leadership, and the seeming preclusion of a two-state solution leaves Israel with one choice: to limit its minority population by any means necessary. And this has been the choice pursued by Israel since its establishment in 1948. Today, such means include discriminatory laws aimed at both limiting the presence as well as impeding the full integration of Palestinians within Israel proper and the occupied Palestinian territories. Within Israel, the state has not only failed to integrate its Palestinian Israelis into a social and national fabric, but it discusses the idea of transfer of those citizens as a matter of pragmatism. Consider that according to a 2008 U.S. State Department report, it says, quote, "public debate continued over the idea of transferring Arab-Israeli communities from Israel to the Palestinian territories in return for transferring Jewish settlements in the West Bank to Israel as part of a negotiated solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Arab-Israelis overwhelmingly condemned the proposal, while Jewish opinion ran the gamut from support to condemnation. In a March poll commissioned by the Knesset television station, 75% of the Jewish public supported the transfer of at least some Arab Israelis as part of a peace deal with the Palestinians, including 28% who believed all Arab Israelis should be forcibly transferred. I don't think it's even necessary to draw the parallel. You can imagine how ridiculous this would sound if stated by a public official in Canada or by a public official in the United States suggesting that the indigenous population be put on buses or trucks or otherwise and crossed and taken across a border in order to meet a demographic equation. And that's not all. Also consider that within the Israeli legal system there are 20 discriminatory laws, 17 of which are discriminatory on their face, in the fact that they only relate to the rights of Jews in Israel, or alternatively, bridge the rights of Palestinian Israelis. A complex web of 1,500 military laws define the fate of Palestinians in the occupied territories, making the tactics in the territories much less subtle and much more violent. Still, in both instances, these policies amount to an apartheid system that aims to diminish the presence of the Palestinian population. In 1973, the United Nations adopted the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, declaring apartheid to be a crime against humanity, and hence made illegal those policies and practices enacted in order to establish and maintain domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group of persons and systematically oppressing them. More broadly, apartheid refers to any social system that separates and discriminates against people based on race or ethnicity when that system is institutionalized by laws and decrees. Therefore, while the South African experience globalized the term, it by no means hegemonized it. And apartheid today continues to refer to a practice as opposed to an experience. And although not a requisite element for establishing the existence of apartheid, there are significant parallels between South African and Israeli apartheid policies. Whereas in South Africa, apartheid distinguished between whites and non-whites, in Israel, the parallel categories are Jews and non-Jews. In an application, the main difference between the two case studies is that in South Africa, the system was created primarily to exploit non-white labor, while in Israel it is implemented in order to control as much land for exclusive Jewish use. However, in both cases, the purpose and effect of apartheid policies are the exploitation of both land and labor. Israeli apartheid characterizes Israeli policies both within Israel proper as well as the occupied territories. In both contexts, a racial hierarchy is firmly established with the primary aim of maintaining a Jewish majority within nation-state borders. The apartheid paradigm has a profound effect on our movement because it simply and brilliantly draws on a historic example of apartheid and calls upon the tactics used in the struggle to fight apartheid in South Africa in its newest form, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And I'm going to transition to a discussion of the movement and leave the rest of the discussion about apartheid and the comparison between South Africa and Palestine, as well as its prevalence between within Israel proper and the territories, to my colleague, Naeem Jina. BDS refers to a tripartite strategy rooted in economic agency and logic that seeks to pressure Israel to comply with international law by making its systematic non-compliance too politically and too economically costly to maintain. Divestment pressures institutions with investments in Israeli companies, or alternatively, in companies that sustain Israeli apartheid to divest those holdings. Similarly, boycotts encourage consumers to exercise their purchasing power and let the market decide favorable foreign policy. By boycotting those goods that benefit from and or sustain Israeli apartheid. Sanctions, on the other hand, cannot be imposed by individuals, but instead only by governments against other governments to impose diplomatic and economic restrictions. I'm going to limit my discussion about the BDS movement to the US, which I hope you'll find relevant here in Canada, given that it is empire today. And so it makes sense that dismantling Israeli apartheid should begin in the US, and to know what the struggle looks like there, which will probably be the hardest struggle to overcome, or the most intransigent. But in BDS, as in most of the world, BDS is popularly associated with a solidarity movement aimed at ending apartheid in South Africa. While immortalized by its peak during the 1980s and its success evidenced by the election of Nelson Mandela, South Africa's 27-year political prisoner and first black president in 1994, the African National Conference called on the world to boycott, divest, and sanction apartheid South Africa decades earlier in 1959. Its legacy in South Africa has made BDS synonymous with grassroots strategies that work. And far from being a radical movement or conception, BDS in the US has actually been employed to sanction and to boycott from nuclear Iran, totalitarian Burma, and genocidal Sudan. But the most controversial strand of BDS has certainly been against Israeli apartheid. As in the case of South Africa, the call for a global BDS campaign against apartheid came from Palestinian civil society. On July 9, 2005, a year after the International Court of Justice's historic decision that declared the rout of the Israel's annexation wall illegal, 170 Palestinian civil society organizations issued a call for BDS. The call reflected a growing movement that appropriately began in Durban, South Africa, at the 2001 World Conference Against Racism, where NGOs and activists equated Israel's racially discriminatory policies throughout Israel proper and the territories as apartheid and advocated that BDS become the strategy of choice. The 2005 call calls on Israel to comply with international law and uphold universal human rights by first, ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands. Second, recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel. And third, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their home as enshrined by UN Resolution 194. The call marked a significant shift in the movement for Palestinian self-determination. Most importantly, it emphasized the rights of Palestinians within Israel, as well as the territories, irrespective of a state-centric solution to the conflict, thereby escaping the internal Palestinian political rife plaguing the Palestinian movement. Solidarity activists have interpreted the BDS call as a referendum against the Oslo Accords and a repudiation of the state-building project that it enshrines. After nearly a decade and a half of Oslo's failure to usher in an era of Palestinian self-determination, coupled with its blighted track record as evidenced by a 100% increase in the number of settlements, the spike in the number of home demolitions, the reinvasion and occupation of the West Bank in 2002, the unfettered construction of the annexation wall, the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, internationally heralded as the end of occupation, despite its unequivocal intransigence in the 140 square mile strip, induced Palestinian civil society to do what its elected leadership should have done: admit the failure of a trilateral peace process and resume the platform of a liberation movement. The latter represents the interests of all Palestinians, and not just those living within the occupied territories, also known as Oslo's illusory boundary for a Palestinian state. This is clearly reflected in the call's second demand for full equality for Israel's Arab and Palestinian citizens. In late November 2009, students representing 40 US-based universities converged upon Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts to collectively strategize about divestment from Israel. Unlike previous divestment conferences where rhetoric for divestment has been high, Hampshire's conference emphasized strategies, lessons learned, and an actual breakdown of how to research and divest from university holdings that sustain or embolden Israeli apartheid. Hampshire's marked departure from past conferences undoubtedly flows from the contribution of at least one generation of former student divestment organizers who attended the 2009 conference as workshop facilitators. And so, armed with practical experience as well as tested PowerPoint presentations and messaging, the organizers help bridge the gap of institutional knowledge inherent to campus activism, where turnover is mandatory every 4 years. And Hampshire's conference in 2009 continues a legacy that began in UC Berkeley in 2001, when on February 6, 2001, the day that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was first elected into office, students filled Sproul Plaza, unfurled a banner that read "Divest from Israeli Apartheid," and launched the first university-based divestment campaign in the US. The following year, UC Berkeley students organized the first national conference of universities engaged in divestment or planning to engage in divestment. And since then, that body of universities coalesced into the Palestinian Solidarity Movement that has met every year, except for the past 3 years up until Hampshire. First at the University of Michigan in 2002, then at Ohio State and Rutgers in 2004, Duke in 2005, Georgetown in 2006, and then after the 3 year lull at Hampshire in 2009. And on February 7th, 2009, 7 months preceding the divestment conference, Hampshire's Board of Trustees voted to divest their holdings from Caterpillar, United Technologies, General Electric, ITT Corporation, and Terex, all of which provide the Israeli military with equipment and services in the occupied territories. For 2 years, SJP Hampshire waged a campaign educating their campus about Israeli human rights violations and collected 800 signatures of students, professors, and alumni endorsing the call to divest from the six companies. 800 is not a lot, by the way. And they were successfully able to convince their board of trustees to divest from apartheid in Israel. And perhaps not coincidentally, Hampshire was also the site of the first successful divestment campaign from South Africa in 1977. Nobel Peace Prize recipient South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu hailed the decision as, quote, "a monumental and historic step for Palestinian equality, self-determination, and peace in the Holy Land by nonviolent means. I see what these students have accomplished as a replica of the support of our struggle against apartheid in South Africa. Hampshire College's decision to divest should be a guiding example to all institutions of higher learning." As evidence of the mainstream nature of BDS, once seen as a marginalized tactic. BDS has now infiltrated even the most liberal organizations in the US, the largest of which is the Presbyterian Church USA, which has 2.3 million members. And in 2004, they endorsed divestment from Israel by a vote of 460-41. The year after, the opposition was so high, threats to burn down churches, calls from Jewish leadership calling this the worst atrocity of anti-Semitism in the US. Despite all the opposition, the PCUSA did not back down from its decision, but reiterated its commitment to divestment in the form of a corporate engagement process. And in the subsequent General Assemblies, they have endorsed it again and again by higher votes. And this year, at their 2010 General Assembly, they're considering not only passing a resolution calling Israeli an apartheid state, but also calling for boycott as well as divestment. Similarly, Code Pink, which you may be familiar with, is a US-based women's peace group. They are known for their notorious head-to-toe attire of pink, sometimes really ugly pink, and their disruption of business as usual on Capitol Hill. Very fearless, a group of women, except they limited their organizing to just Afghanistan and Iraq, feeling that that was where US empire was, and not venturing into Palestine because of their membership. And in 2006, they declared their support for Palestine very quietly. But after 2009, in the aftermath of Operation Cast Lead, the devastating Israeli invasion, offensive, aerial and ground offensive against the Gaza Strip, Code Pink adopted its campaign against occupation in Palestine as its front and center campaign, has since taken two delegations to the Gaza Strip and launched the Stolen Beauty campaign, which is a boycott campaign against Ahava, a cosmetics company that is based in the West Bank, and they've achieved tremendous success, including convincing Oxfam to drop its spokesperson, Kristen Davis, the starlet of Sex in the City, the more demure one, I suppose, as their goodwill ambassador, because she's also a spokesperson for Ahava. And finally, let me mention Adala, New York's BDS campaign, which, by the way, didn't exist before Israeli Apartheid Week, but was an outgrowth of Israeli Apartheid Week. They've targeted Lev Lviv, a diamond mogul in New York, who has a company called Africa Israel, and have convinced the Danske Bank, which is a Danish bank, as well as the Danish pension fund, to exclude Lviv's enterprise, Africa Israel, from its investment portfolio. They also encouraged UNICEF, Oxfam, and the British government, as well as several Hollywood actors, to distance themselves from the entrepreneur for his role in settlement construction. Their ability to influence institutional behavior puts Adala New York, Code Pink, and Hampshire in a small group of BDS campaigns that have had a tangible economic impact. But for other campaigns, the fruits of their labor cannot be measured in economic units. But their virtue instead has been the ability to challenge Israel's moral authority and undermine its legitimacy. Arguably, Israel's most coveted arsenal, shielding it from international accountability norms. This is acutely the case in the US, where in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, Israel's image as a David among an Arab Goliath took firm hold among many Americans and has henceforth informed US Middle East policy. In June 1968, the Johnson administration, with strong support from Congress, approved the sale of supersonic aircraft to Israel and effectively established the US's precedent of supporting Israel's qualitative military edge over its neighbors. I feel like I'm talking a lot and I'm reading from you, so I think I might have gone over time. So let me just continue by not reading this and telling you the moral of this story. The purpose of BDS and its virtue is not just in economic units, as I've mentioned, but its ability to puncture holes in Israel's security narrative, which tries to position that everything that Israel does, from the West Bank to East Jerusalem to Gaza to within Israel proper to Lebanon to Syria to Egypt, as part of its struggle to survive and its struggle for its existence. What BDS does is brilliantly punctures holes in this narrative. And that's been demonstrated most recently by the Reut Institute study, which found that the grassroots movement, rather than move from the top down and the center out, moves from the out to the center and the bottom up to challenge Israel's moral authority, and in a few years will pose an existential threat to Israel, BDS. And so this I'm actually going to skip. I'm going to leave the rest to you to discuss about the differences between the Afrikaner, the fact that there was no Afrikaner lobby like AIPAC that exists in order to diminish the power of this movement. But I'll leave those parallels to Naeem and end with a note about we're not just choosing BDS. It's not as if we're sitting in a room and we're deciding what's the best strategy to pursue to actually attack or to diminish the presence or to dismantle Israeli apartheid. But the truth of the matter is that we have been left with no other choice. If you consider legal avenues that could be pursued, from the International Court of Justice to universal jurisdiction to third-party tribunals like in the US, all avenues seem to be closed. Palestinians can't bring their claims in the International Criminal Court because they're not considered a state. Universal jurisdiction is being diminished because Israeli diplomacy is working to create new laws to diminish universal jurisdiction, which allows any state to prosecute for war crimes and crimes against humanity without, notwithstanding, the lack of presence of the accused or the victim. This is what happened in 2001. When Belgian courts filed a suit against Ariel Sharon for his atrocities in Sabra and Shatila in 1982. Not only was the case never prosecuted, but Israeli diplomats also convinced Belgians to change their law completely so that universal jurisdiction doesn't even exist. Consider also that the US's unequivocal and unconditional support in the form of diplomacy, as evidenced by UN Security Council resolutions that have been vetoed between 1972 and 2006, the US has vetoed 42 resolutions. The fact that there's $3 billion of aid sent every year, notwithstanding Israel's violations and its contravention of US foreign policy, makes it incumbent upon us to pursue the only strategy to transcend these obstacles. And that strategy is to boycott, divest, and sanction apartheid Israel. Thank you.
Thank you, Nora, for that. So we're going to move on to our next speaker. So Naeem Jinas.